No. I don't want 20 minutes. I have no prepared statement because I thought Tom would take the whole time. I'll just make a couple of remarks, but I also give my thanks to the tribunal for inviting me, especially the opportunity to defend such an illustrious group of people in foreign policy. I feel today, in light of yesterday's events, somewhat like an attorney, although I'm a journalist. Actually, I would say I was a reporter. Insofar as you've got someone on trial for a serial murder, you've worked really hard to get them out on bail. They get on bail, the day of the trial arrives, and you find out that they've gone to Canada or some other place. That's in light of yesterday's events in Washington, D.C. In any event, I wanted to thank the tribunal for inviting me, and I have symbolic gifts that I'd like to present. In light of all the papers that are involved in the basic work that we have to do here, I thought that paperweights were in order. I went to Washington, D.C. souvenir shop and found just the paperweights that I wanted. Okay, I'll give them to the chair.
Thank you very much.
They're in the shape
it's
of a pentagon.
It's a reproduction of the Pentagon.
This is the latest souvenir in Washington, D.C., post-9/11. You'll notice, however, that there are trees all around this pentagon. This shows the earnestness with which this administration takes global warming. They want to help. In any event, I won't take long. As I said, I didn't expect to speak in an opening session. I found Tom's remarks extremely provocative and very interesting, and I hope they go appreciated in the secret chambers of PNAC, although I doubt they will, in part because there are no secret chambers of PNAC. But I would like to make three general points in my opening that I hope perhaps we can pursue a little bit. And they anticipate to some extent, or they postscript to some extent what Tom has said. The major kind of philosophical thrust of PNAC as a group or as a set of documents has to do as much with the issue of morality as they do with geostrategy. And it derives from a neoconservative current of opinion. And I think there's a lot of confusion about what neoconservatism is. There's enormous confusion, particularly when neoconservatives deny that such a movement even exists, as they do, or at least some of them do. What I believe defines neoconservatism as it has developed since the late 1960s, indeed since around the 67 war, has a lot to do with Israel and, in a sense, the plight of the Jews or the fate of the Jews in the aftermath of the Nazi Holocaust. And indeed, the most important publication of neoconservative thought since the late 60s has been Commentary Magazine, which is published by the American Jewish Committee, although it's very important to note that the American Jewish Committee does not take positions that are generally neoconservative in orientation. The major issue, in a sense, of Jews and for many intellectuals post-Holocaust was how did this happen? How was it that 6 million people could be systematically murdered in a country and the world really, including the United States in many ways, not doing anything about it? And out of this comes a question of, is international law and international institutions, can they do anything about a situation like this? Could they have done anything to prevent it? And indeed, certainly before the Genocide Convention was approved and ratified, there really was no legal instrument that could be called upon that would have effectively stopped the Holocaust other than war. Now, I think this issue was incorporated in the minds of neoconservatisms. That is, law, particularly international law, has great limitations in protecting people, not just Jews, but any oppressed minority. And indeed, you'll recall that even during the 90s, when there was no veto in the UN Security Council, there were a number of instances, well, at least Rwanda was a particularly dramatic example, in which the law was not implemented by the mechanisms, the multilateral mechanisms, that were supposed to invoke that law. And they see that as highly immoral. And the long and short of what I'm trying to say is that that neoconservatives think that international law, or even any law, may be in conflict at certain moments with basic morality. And that informs a lot of their views or their contempt for international law and multilateral institutions. And I think that has to be borne in mind. After all, it was neoconservatives who led the charge, who pressured President Clinton to intervene in Bosnia, not to save Jews, not to save Christians, to save Muslims. And similarly, it was they who led the charge in Kosovo. Now, I'm not saying they act consistently in any way, in every time, nor do I say that they are not cynical in the application of some of their principles, because it would be silly for me to make such a suggestion. But I think one of the fundamental critiques that neoconservatism has toward the existing international legal system is that it is not necessarily moral. In fact, it can be highly immoral or amoral. And that particularly when you have five permanent members who can exercise vetoes, the United Nations is a particularly feckless institution for protecting the rights of people when they are in extreme danger. And I think that is at the core of a lot of neoconservative thinking, and because neoconservatives, I would say, are predominant in PNAC, that is one of the central currents, I think, of the project for the New American Century. They also see that with respect to the United States, one of the causes of the Holocaust, in their view, which really is the central point of it's their historical reference point, if you will, as American isolationism. That is that the United States has practiced isolationism for the vast majority of its existence, and it only pretty much dropped isolationism as a policy after World War II. And they see that as an extreme danger, because they see the United States as a moral force for good. Again, that may be, you know, different people have different views about that, but they view that in that way, that again, it is a moral question for them. And they see that American isolationism must not be permitted to return, because the world will be a much worse place if it does. And I think they sincerely believe that. So the question is, how do you keep the United States engaged politically and morally with the rest of the world? And as Tom more or less pointed out in his presentation, their argument is you do that by potentially asserting U.S. predominance over the world and U.S. responsibility for the world. This is their response to the question of avoiding isolationism. Neoconservative who was on the Defense Policy Board with Richard Perle, a man named Kenneth Edelman, who said, incidentally, that is famous for having said in an article in Washington Post that going to Iraq will be a, quote, cakewalk, unquote, said at, during one radio interview that the default option in U.S. foreign policy is isolationism. And that is seen as the worst possible alternative by neoconservatives. And so they're trying to erect a role for the world, for the United States in the world, that absolutely ensures that isolationism is not an option. I personally believe they are deluded in that they may be hastening a new era of isolationism, but this is nonetheless, I think, the views that they hold. Finally, I think there's enormous confusion about PNAC itself. I've read some of the documents that refer to the in our texts that refer to people, reporters like myself, uncovering secret PNAC documents. They're not secret. PNAC has a long paper trail. They publish everything they do because they think people should know, and they're proud of their views. So the notion of secrecy, I think, is a non-starter if we take that up or if we make that assumption. PNAC is tiny. PNAC consists of about four people. What it really is it's a kind of platform by which various currents currently on the right can express their views about foreign policy issues. And what happens is someone will draft, someone in PNAC or someone outside of PNAC whom they consult will draft a statement, and PNAC will circulate it and see how many signers they get. And if they get enough signers that represent enough different currents of opinion, they will publish it as theirs. And it's very, very interesting to note that PNAC collectively has not published a single document with numerous signatures since January 2003. It has been, for purposes of a collective action representing different currents on the right, it has been dormant for almost a year and a half. And I think that needs to be understood. We are not talking about the heart of the military-industrial complex, which is constantly hatching schemes here. They are deeply divided, I believe, and over what comes after Iraq. And even as the United States was invading Iraq in March of 2003, they signed on to documents with liberal internationalists, the kind that Tom was talking about, implicitly attacking members of their own constituency, such as Donald Rumsfeld, for now having conquered Iraq, wanting to get out fast, and not taking responsibility for trying to rebuild Iraq, which they felt very strongly was absolutely essential. I think there, as I say, there are many things that, I think the mythology around PNAC is quite strong, and it's building all the time. And I have no disagreement with the notion that PNAC did form the basis of the post-9/11 foreign policy through the Iraq War. But I think it's very important that we learn more about the subtleties, the contradictions that exist among various associates and affiliates and currents within PNAC, and that we try to use this occasion to the best possible degree of learning more about how complicated U.S. policy circles are and exactly how it is they come up with this thinking and why they think the way they think. I'm sorry, I probably took the entire 20 minutes, and I apologize for the ad hoc nature of my opening remarks.
Thank you very much, Jim Lobb, for your intervention.